This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Hey, I'm Lisa Loving. I'm the PM, KBOO PM News Director. Tonight we're starting a process of tinkering with our evening news broadcast. We're running free speech radio news in its entirety, followed by the locally produced KBOO Evening News. We'd like to know what you think about the broadcast. Please email me at pmnews@kboo.org or call 503-231-8032, extension 203. Also, we'd like to encourage more listeners with story ideas, especially from areas outside Portland. Later this week, we'll be setting up a story tip line. Please stay tuned for that change as well. Change is a process. Listen and get back to me. Do you like it? Do you hate it? Let me know at pmnews@kboo.org or 503-231-8032, extension 203. Thanks and stay tuned. This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Tuesday, the 10th of January, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. New Orleans hotels attempt to evict Hurricane Katrina survivors to make way for tourists. Another city in Orange County, California, is considering deputizing local police to enforce federal immigration law. And it's day two for Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito's confirmation hearings. We'll bring you these stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A new study has determined that the Bush administration's original estimate of the cost of the war in Iraq may be radically lower than the actual long-term cost. Quinn Bowman reports from Washington, D.C.
Economists Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes determined that the war may cost up to $2 trillion. The pair included factors the U.S. government has not included in their overall price tag for the war, like the cost of providing health care to injured or maimed soldiers, the increase in the U.S. deficit, and the funds needed to recruit new soldiers, as well as the rise in oil prices. Although the White House estimated the war could cost between $100 and $200 billion, Stiglitz says that even the study's estimate is a conservative one.
To take a very conservative approach, we assumed only $5 of the increase is due to the war in Iraq. I think a more reasonable number is a substantially higher fraction of the increase in the cost of oil is due to the war in Iraq. And that, if you did that, you would wind up with a much higher number.
The study, which Stiglitz says was purposely conservative in order to stifle charges that he was exaggerating the findings, assumes that U.S. troop levels in Iraq will decrease every year until a full withdrawal in 2010. Report co-author Linda Bilmes is a Harvard lecturer, while Joseph Stiglitz is the 2001 Nobel laureate in economics. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Quinn Bowman in Washington, D.C.
Foreign secretaries from Central America, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and Colombia have issued a joint declaration calling for a more pragmatic approach to the question of immigration enforcement. Vladimir Flores has the story.
The foreign secretaries are meeting in Mexico City to construct a regional consensus regarding immigration policy. This after the U.S. House of Representatives passed controversial legislation in December. The bill calls for the expansion of the metal wall along the U.S.-Mexico border and will classify the act of working without proper documentation as a felony. The measure has sparked widespread criticism in Mexico, where the border wall is seen as a symbol of xenophobia and irrational immigration policy. Although exact numbers are unknown, an estimated 4 million Mexicans live and work in the U.S. without legal documentation. Money sent back by workers in the form of remittances is Mexico's second largest source of revenue. The U.S. Senate is expected to debate the House-approved immigration bill in February. Oaxaca, Mexico, Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, has announced that the United States will send a delegation to the disputed border region between Ethiopia and Eritrea. The neighboring countries fought a bitter war over the demarcation, which claimed over 70,000 lives between 1998 and 2000. A border agreement was reached in 2002, but Ethiopia has refused to withdraw from Badme, a town awarded to Eritrea. The UN mission to Ethiopia and Eritrea has issued a number of warnings over the past few months of escalating tensions in the temporary security zone, and troop movements have been reported on both sides. Ethiopia and Eritrea could face sanctions for failure to reduce troops under the terms of a resolution passed in November by the UN Security Council. Two Argentine police were convicted yesterday of murdering two unemployed activists, or piqueteros, during a protest in June of 2002. Marie Trigona reports from Buenos Aires.
An Argentine court sentenced a police chief and an officer to life in prison yesterday for the 2002 killings of two piquetero activists, Dario Santillan and Maximiliano Costecchi. The two former officers were also charged with attempting to kill another eight protesters during a police crackdown of a road blockade near the suburban Avellaneda train station. Six other police officers received sentences of 10 months to 4 years in prison for covering up the killings. News footage and photographs helped identify the two at the scene of the homicide and provide proof that police tried to cover up evidence of having used live ammunition against demonstrators. At least 33 people were wounded by lead bullets during the 2002 protest. Piqueteros have staged monthly blockades at the Puerolan Bridge, the site of the 2002 killings, to demand criminal prosecution of the intellectual authors of the police crackdown. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marie Trigona in Buenos Aires.
The New Jersey legislature approved a moratorium on capital punishment yesterday. The state will suspend executions while a panel evaluates the use of the death penalty. The commission is due to present their findings in mid-November. Yesterday's vote marks the first time a U.S. state legislature has passed a death penalty moratorium. Previous moratoriums in Illinois and Maryland were ordered by the state's governors. New Jersey Governor Richard Cody is expected to sign the bill into law within 7 days. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. Supreme Court nominee Samuel Alito spent a second day in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee defending his record. Alito faced questions about his decisions during his 15 years on an appellate court, his views on the expansion of presidential power, and his membership in a college organization that advocated discrimination against women and people of color. FSRN's Selena Masuta reports from the hearings in Washington, D.C.
In many ways, the Alito hearings are similar to the hearings that Chief Justice John Roberts went through during his confirmation. Just like those put to Roberts, questions concerning whether Alito would uphold what courts have ruled before, also known as stare decisis, were the center of many senators' questions. Pointing to a list of 35 precedents supporting abortion, chair of the committee and Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania asked Alito how he would take into account precedents when making decisions on issues like abortion. Specter also referred to a 1985 memo that Alito wrote.
Let me come now to the statement you made in 1985 that the Constitution does not provide a basis for a woman's right to an abortion. Do you agree with that statement today, Judge Alito?
I would approach the question with an open mind, and I would listen to the arguments.
So you would approach it with an open mind, notwithstanding your 1985 statement?
Absolutely, Senator. That was a statement that I made at a prior period of time when I was performing a different role.
But as Democrats promised this weekend, their questions to Alito, unlike with Roberts, are packed with a punch, especially in the wake of revelations that President Bush secretly ordered the National Security Agency to conduct wiretaps of U.S. citizens, an issue that could possibly come before the Supreme Court in the future. Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, like many Democrats in the partisan panel, raised concerns that Alito's records show favoritism to the executive branch. Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont also questioned Alito and his membership in a Princeton alumni group opposed to the admission of women and people of color. While applying for a job at the Reagan administration, Alito included his membership in his application.
Why in heaven's name were you proud of being part of CAP?
Well, Senator, I have racked my memory about this issue, and I really have no specific recollection of that organization. But since I put it down on that statement, then I certainly must have been a member at that time. But if I had been actively involved in the organization in any way, if I had attended meetings or been actively involved in any way, I would certainly remember that, and I don't.
You are replacing someone who has been the fulcrum, otherwise evenly divided court. She fully understood the real world of discrimination. I mean, she felt it.
Senator Joseph Biden, a Delaware Democrat, is referring to retiring Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. For supporters and critics of O'Connor, O'Connor offered a real-world perspective that took into account how institutions affect individuals. Using an anti-discrimination case called the Bray case that Alito ruled against, Biden questioned whether Alito would be able to offer that O'Connor framework of decision-making.
You and your colleagues disagreed. Two of your colleagues said, you know, Ms. Bray should have a jury trial here. And you said, no, I don't think she should. And you set out a standard. And your colleagues said that if they applied your standard in Title VII cases, that is, discrimination cases, that it would effectively, their words, eviscerate Title VII, because they went on to say it ignores the realities of racial animus.
The confirmation hearings will continue until Thursday night. The Senate is scheduled to vote on Alito's confirmation on January the 20th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Selena Masuta.
Haiti finds itself in a sea of turmoil as presidential elections in the troubled Caribbean nation were recently delayed for the fourth time. Business elites have called for UN soldiers in the country to crack down on poor neighborhoods, while a general strike gripped Haiti on Monday. Aaron Lakoff has more from Port-au-Prince.
As January the 8th passed, the day the presidential elections were supposed to be held in Haiti, but delayed again for the fourth time, the Caribbean nation finds itself in a state of violence and strife. On Saturday morning, General Bacelar, the Brazilian head of the United Nations military mission in Haiti, was found dead in his hotel room from an apparent suicide. Meanwhile, Reginald Boulos, head of the Haitian Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and sweatshop owner Andy Aped, called for a general business strike to commence on Monday. The goal of the strike, to pressure MINUSTA, the UN stabilization mission in Haiti, to crack down harder on poor areas of Port-au-Prince. Impoverished neighborhoods such as Cité Soleil are seen to be strongholds for favored presidential candidate René Préval and his Lavalas party. Residents of Cité Soleil have come under intense UN fire over the last week. Dionard and May, whose wife Annette Moléon was killed by MINUSTA forces on Wednesday, explains. While the shooting was happening, she was with two children, and she said to the children, "Leave where you are, because there is shooting here." And then one ran away. And at the same time, one stood there. And in the same way, when he saw the shooting, he ran and ducked under a table and hid himself there. It is when they didn't hear any more shooting that he stuck his head out, but MINUSTA was shooting there, where he stuck his head out, and there he sustained a bullet wound to his mouth that exited the back of his head, and he died on the spot. They came to get me. They told me, "There, your wife is dead," and I came and picked her up. Mariella, another eyewitness to UN shooting, explains the violence that took place in the Cité Soleil marketplace on Wednesday. While we were sitting there, those foreigners, they began to fire, all of us. The market vendors, we had to lie on the ground. Then there was a market vendor who died in the market. You must see the bullet holes, all the parts of those poles, how they're riddled with bullets. Then they shot us, taking us to the ground. There were people who sustained bullet wounds, and until now, there are people in the hospital. There are people whose feet are broken. Who fired? MINUSTA fired on the people at the marketplace. Then we lied on the ground. They made all of our chests completely flat. They were firing, so we stayed there. We didn't receive any intervention. We didn't find any reporters to come. Many residents of Cité Soleil are angered by the role that MINUSTA is playing and see them as pandering to Haiti's elite. Some have described their actions as political cleansing prior to the elections. Jean-Joseph Joël of Famille Lavalas. We think that the international community must now try to redefine its policy in Haiti. MINUSTAH must cease being manipulated by the private business sector, stop taking orders from the hands of Baker, Boulos, and Aped at the detriment of the masses, to destroy the people of Cité Soleil, Bel Air, Soleno, La Fossette, to destroy all who live in popular neighborhoods. Elections are now scheduled to take place on February 7th, with a runoff on March 19th. The elections, which many Haitians call selections, come after democratically elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted on February 29th, 2004, in a coup d'état sponsored by the U.S., France, and Canada. This is Aaron Lakoff reporting for Free Speech Radio News in Port-au-Prince, Haiti.
Iran's supervisory board on the press ordered the closure of a daily newspaper last week, and it banned a new women's biweekly magazine. This is the first time the new ultra-conservative Iranian government has ordered the closure of publications since August. Both publications say they will announce plans for the future of their work this week. Iranian affairs correspondent Saida Jamshidi has the story.
This is the fourth time the daily business newspaper Asia has been ordered to close down. Now, the Minister of Islamic Education and Guidance has leveled strong accusations against the paper, which include publishing photos of improperly dressed women, publishing stories that compromised Iran's national security, and for being anti-Islamic. Each one of these accusations carries a heavy sentence under Iranian law.
All of these accusations are disgusting, voiceless, and meaningless. I don't believe that even people in the Ministry of Islamic Education and Guidance would ever buy such ideas themselves.
That's Iraj Jamshidi, the chief editor of the Asia newspaper, who previously had been imprisoned for 400 days and interrogated more than 109 times.
Since 2002, I spoke with different radio stations, including BBC, Voice of America, and Radio France International, about the changes in Iran and the Middle East, giving an expert analysis. What I said during these interviews led me to being accused by the Iranian government of being a spy for England and America. They said that publishing photos and reporting stories about American politicians and diplomats in the region, especially U.S. Secretary of State's Condoleezza Rice's policies in the Middle East, showed my interest toward America and the West.
What are seen by reformists as unrealistic accusations against their newspapers over the past 5 years had led to the temporary suspension of distribution of more than 100 publications. Behman Bakhtiari is a professor of political science in the University of Maine and is an observer of Iranian politics.
What you have in Iran today, you have transformation and a lot of change without democratization. Less and less democracy for people, less and less human rights, and less press freedom. And the future of this government cannot be that good.
With the ultra-conservative government that came to power in the summer of 2005, along with the conservative parliament, the country is in hands of just one political group. But this may be to Iran's disadvantage. Again, Behman Bakhtiari.
I think the level of tension right now in Iran is the highest I can remember since really 1979-1980 hostage crisis in Iran. I cannot recall such a high level of international tension against Iran caused by the government of Iran, mostly. The Iranian government is taking a very risky road, and this particular government in Iran is so religiously tied and dogmatic.
Freedom of the press is supposedly guaranteed under Iran's constitution, but the so-called golden era for journalists lasted only 2 years, from 1997 to 1999, when then-reformist President Mohammad Khatami was in office. Dozens of reporters have been harassed, kidnapped, and tortured by unknown hardline supporters over the last few years. Reporters don't seem to have a promising chance with the new conservative president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Saida Jamshidi.
Four New Orleans hotels attempted to illegally evict displaced residents Monday. The hotel rooms are being paid through FEMA temporary housing vouchers, and Hurricane Katrina survivors worry that while FEMA continues to extend deadlines, more hotels will be attempting to displace evacuees with tourists. Maiba Liebenthal reports from New Orleans.
Brian Washington stood outside the Cotton Exchange Hotel in the city's central business district Monday with a group of friends after being evicted from the hotel with no options for another place to stay. He and other guests say they had first been harassed and then told to leave.
It was about 10-something, and they were saying you had to be out by 11. They came around 10-something and tried to get us out the room. They was also saying something about FEMA was supposed to be extending it. But she still got put out. I had to leave on the spot. Yeah, they got other people. They got other people, you know. They got people out here walking outside, leaving out their room with children. They're all their clothes. They got people leaving out here with box fans and everything. You know, all their possessions, big stuff, got to walk on the street because they just put them out like that. And that ain't right.
After a similar situation on Saturday at another New Orleans hotel where 100 evacuees with FEMA vouchers were being evicted, Orleans Parish Civil Court Judge Michael Bagnaris put a temporary restraining order on such evictions. However, the management of the Cotton Exchange supported its decision to evict a small number of residents, explaining that they were given timely notification and had the ability to ask for an extension on their stay.
We have done everything we can to accommodate every single person that we can on the FEMA program or otherwise. We gave notice last week after the deadline of the 7th, then if you needed to extend, please come talk to us and let us know you need to extend.
Management and lawyers outside disagreed on the number of people evicted. Miles Granderson of the Grassroots Legal Network explained that not all of the requests to stay were honored. While some hotels have let residents stay, survivors and supporters are concerned that this is just the beginning of pressure to make evacuees leave their temporary homes to make room for tourists, college staff, and parents.
I'm Courtney DeSalle. You know, I'm an evacuee. I mean, I have no place to go. I mean, yeah, it would be lovely if I could go by a family member, but all my family members lived in the night war in New Orleans East, and everybody lost everything. I mean, like I say, after the 16, I'll still be looking for extension because I'm still down here. My family's out in Colorado Springs, and there's a lot of elderly people in my family, and they can't do anything themselves, you know. So we're the younger ones trying to gut the houses out for them and stuff like that, you know, and work at the same time, you know. So we want to get back home. Trust me, we're some true New Orleanians, you know. We love Mardi Gras, but right now Mardi Gras just ain't the thing for us, you know. I've been riding on the Mardi Gras float since I was 5 years old, and I would hate to miss it. But, you know, we're just trying to go get our house back right now, you know, not the bees and stuff, you know.
The temporary restraining order is in effect until a full court hearing this Friday, January 13th. These are the first private hotels that have been enjoined with this particular order. Lawyer Jennifer Lai of the Advancements Project, a member of the legal team fighting these evictions, says this order may be used for many corporate chains around the country. Until this happens, Courtney DeSalle, Brian Washington, and others worry that without this protection, they may find themselves homeless due to the inadequate housing support from FEMA and other government agencies. For Free Speech Radio News in New Orleans, this is Maiba Liebenthal.
Rank-and-file United Auto Workers union members are organizing nationwide to fight back wage and benefit concession demands made by giant auto parts maker Delphi and General Motors. Hundreds of workers protested what they call the GM Delphi assault on the working class at this Sunday's Detroit Auto Show. Delphi, which filed for bankruptcy late last year, originally demanded 60% in cuts, but in the face of union resistance has since backed off, at least temporarily, in favor of a consensus agreement with its unions. But Delphi could still file in bankruptcy court as early as February to void union contracts and pension obligations. If that happens, the UAW could strike, crippling not only Delphi, but GM along with it. With 1 in 7 jobs in the U.S. being auto-related, from sales to parts to service and more, these developments could have enormous implications for U.S. workers and the nation's economy. Doug Cunningham spoke with auto workers on Detroit streets on Sunday who expressed determination to resist the use of bankruptcy laws to impose what they say are poverty wages.
GM, Delphi, you should know we won't be your Patco. GM, Delphi, you should know.
About 500 rank-and-file workers marched at the Detroit Auto Show Sunday to protest the Delphi GM concession demands. Todd Jordan works at Delphi in Kokomo, Indiana.
I'm here today because of the GM Delphi assault on the working class. We are going to work to rule, and we are going to fight this back through trade union militancy on the shop floor. And we'll take it to the streets if need be.
Don Gale works at the Flint East plant.
I've been a loyal employee, and now they want to take away part of the pension, maybe all of the pension benefits. They're taking jobs away from America. They're just point blank trying to eliminate the working class of America. Not just the UAW, they're going after every class of worker.
Stacy Kemp from Saginaw, Michigan, had this message for UAW President Ron Gettelfinger.
I would like you to advocate for us in an honest way and stop leaving the rank and file out of the loop.
This unidentified auto worker wants to spark revolutionary action.
Get off your ass. We need a Boston Tea Party. We need to dump Chinese auto parts in the river as they get off the boat.
For Free Speech Radio News, Doug Cunningham, Workers Independent News.
Yet another city in Orange County, California, is considering leveraging local law enforcement resources in targeting undocumented immigrants as enabled by the Homeland Security Act of 2002. The city of Cypress is proposing to clear the way to deputize local police to enforce federal immigration law. Kelly Barnes was in Cypress last night, where the public had an opportunity to comment on the proposal.
The level of rhetoric was ratcheted up by Phil Trine of Costa Mesa, whose comments revealed cleavages in the traditional anti-immigrant coalitions.
Thank you for allowing me to say a few words tonight in favor of permitting the Cypress police to arrest criminal invaders within Cypress city limits. Hopefully, Cypress and Costa Mesa can fire shot heard are all around the country and bring other cities into the battle against this Washington-promoted treasonous invasion.
The states of Florida, Alabama, Arizona, and the counties of Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and Riverside all have agreements with the Patriot Act Authorized Agency, Immigration Control and Enforcement, or ICE. The agreements allow detaining officers to scrutinize and interrogate incoming arrestees regarding their immigration status. A plan favored by the Orange County Sheriff's Department to allow both patrolling and detaining officers to conduct immigration interrogations was dropped when the sheriff's community advisors opposed the deputization of field officers. Last month, in overflowing chambers, the Orange County City of Costa Mesa voted 3-2 to ask the ICE to create a 3.5-week training course to get their officers up to speed on immigration law, civil rights, intercultural relations, and racial profiling. At that meeting, Coyotl Tezcatlipoca, an activist with the Tonantzin Collective, was shown in a video being arrested and roughed up by police. He was charged with disrupting the meeting of the Costa Mesa City Council, although the meeting was in recess at the time. Activist Rosalinda Guillen said Tezcatlipoca chose to skip last night's meeting in Cyprus on the same topic, lest the message of the activists opposing the measure be clouded by an obsession with his presence. In a partial victory for the activists, the Cyprus City Council ultimately agreed to only send letters of support to Costa Mesa and Orange County in their efforts and to not pursue their own program. Scott Sink of Anaheim is a member of the Tonantzin Activist Collective. He said the measures under consideration would be ineffective.
It's been sold as a way to deport dangerous felons. However, it does not make sense to have immigration being enforced at a local police level. It would not increase deportation of convicted felons, since there are already immigration agents at county and state correctional facilities.
Minutemen founder Jim Gilchrist and also Peace and Freedom failed congressional candidate from Orange County weighed in and boasted of bipartisan support for expanded domestic police powers.
I will be on the East Coast very shortly. We will be promoting the same type of activity. This is something that is transcending party lines. Republicans and now a Democrat, Executive Steve Levy in Farmingville, New York, has been doing what you plan to do and what Costa Mesa Mayor Mansoor plans to do for about 6 months now. He's literally enforcing the law.
Eileen Garcia of Laguna Beach echoed the fear message of those who would scapegoat immigrants, and Rosalinda Guillen, a teacher and resident of Santa Ana, on the effect of the debate on the community.
I'm hoping that you do not allow Cypress to become entangled in this drama. The proposal divided our community in Costa Mesa. Ever since it was approved, there have been protests, there's been arrests, and there's been nonstop racial tension at the high schools. Please do not support the ethnic cleansing taking place in Costa Mesa. Thank you.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kelly Barnes for the People Without Borders Collective and FSRN.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo de Landeros Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, changes at Jefferson High School are getting lots of attention.
A live interview with John Stevens of Mercy Corps.
And hear the latest news from Tryon Farms.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,210 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports over 31,000 civilians have been killed, reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah since the invasion.
Coming up at 6, Out Loud hosts Humble Divas presenting pieces from their musical comedy Civil Disunion. At 7 o'clock, it's Amanda's Jam Corner.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. I'm Lori Hilliard.
And I'm Doug Guidi. Striking Josephine County workers picketed the old Jackson County Courthouse on Tuesday to warn commissioners they're not to send replacement workers to fill jobs held by strikers. About 10 people from the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees set up an information picket line outside the commissioner's offices after the union received word that Jackson County had agreed to send a few managers to Josephine County to staff mental health services, said Long Holston, field representative for Oregon AFSCME Council 75. Quote, "We went over to Jackson County to send a clear message that if they align themselves with Josephine County, we'll put on information pickets to point out that they are spending Jackson County assets to benefit Josephine County," unquote, Holston said. Jackson County Administrator Sue Slack confirmed that the county had offered replacement workers, but so far none have gone. The number would be just a few to staff mental health facilities, she said. Josephine County Commissioner said in a statement that more than 200 people, about two-thirds of the workers represented by Ask Me, went on strike Monday. They were primarily from the mental health, public health, and the community justice departments. Ask Me employees turned down the county's final offer of a 1.2% wage increase and cuts in vacation, sick, and personal time. The offer also eliminated county contributions to a deferred compensation program. The county statement said officials spent part of the weekend interviewing temporary workers to replace strikers in critical care functions, and they moved juvenile offenders to custody in Jackson County. Mediated talks are scheduled for Thursday. Sheriff Dave Daniel, who is running for county commissioner, spoke in support of strikers, characterizing the current commissioners as thugs and bullies. "The county has more than 400 employees. Only four of them are overpaid," said Daniel, referring to raises given by commissioners to division directors.
We have had a series of reports about Tryon Farms and their fundraising efforts. This may be the last story of the series. KBOO's Jim Thompson reports.
So good evening. I'm speaking with Lee Callen of Tryon Farms. We have been reporting on their fundraising efforts to try to secure their property, and I know that they've been at risk. So we're talking with Lee Callen. Lee, how are you?
I'm great.
You're great. You have good news, I hope.
Yes, we have very good news.
Well, let's hear it.
Well, we went down to the title company today at 11 a.m., signed all of the papers that we needed to sign, have all of the money that we need, $1.425 million
wow.
in an escrow account waiting to transfer to the landowners. So we have fulfilled our end of the deal We did it.
You did it. What's the atmosphere? What's the mood like there? I can't imagine.
Oh my gosh. Very relieved, a little bit tired, I have to say. And we're preparing for a press conference tomorrow morning at 11 a.m. So, we sent out a press advisory. I'm actually right now writing up a big email to the world, telling everyone to celebrate. And we're just kind of,
you're kind of
work mode here.
Yeah. Okay. How long has this process been going on?
Whoa. I guess I would say about 2 years has been the vision and work towards creating this education center has been about 2 years. It's only been about 10 months of fundraising. Yeah.
And in 10 months, you raised a lot of money for a wonderful adventure.
I would like to make it clear that the reason that we have all of that money, one, is because there has been an incredible amount of community support every single day, just pouring in. So I just want to thank people profusely, and I'm just in awe of the Portland community at the moment. We also had some last-minute bridge loans that allowed us to come up with the final $15,000 that we were short yesterday. So we are still fundraising to cover those bridge loans and pay back the short-term loans that we did receive yesterday.
Ah, that's good to know.
So just so everyone knows, we're still fundraising.
Okay. Thank you so much for this note, and all the best.
Thank you so much, Jim.
For KBOO, I'm Jim Thompson.
In about 3.5 hours on Monday, Oregon State Police troopers issued 10 speeding tickets, including one for driving 106 miles per hour, 6 citations for failing to maintain a safe distance from emergency vehicles, and 4 for following too closely. In a saturation patrol focusing on speed, aggressive driving, and other high-risk violations, 9 state troopers on the ground worked with a pilot in the state police Cessna 210 to locate, educate, and sometimes penalize violators in Marion and Polk counties. Monday's patrol began at 10 a.m. and concluded about 1:30 p.m. The focus was on Interstate 5 between Salem and Woodburn, Highway 99 East between Gervis and Woodburn, 15 south of Salem, and the safety corridor on Highway 22 West, chosen because they were identified as among the worst for crashers by the Oregon Department of Transportation. Failure to maintain safe distance from an emergency vehicle or ambulance says that a driver in the slow lane must change lanes or slow down if a lane change isn't safe when passing a police car or ambulance that is parked on the side of the road and has flashing emergency lights. The same lane change rule is necessary if the police car or ambulance is parked on the left-hand side of the road nearest the fast lane.
New plans at Jefferson High School to require uniforms and create single-gender schools have students and adults distressed. KBOO's Angela Hancock Revis reports.
Changes to Jefferson High School's structure are touching off a groundswell of opposition. At last night's Portland School Board meeting, District Superintendent Vicki Phillips formally presented plans to address No Child Left Behind requirements at the North Portland High School and the schools that feed into it. According to the Federal Education Act, if student achievement at Jefferson is not improved, the school faces sanctions, including eventual closure. The board will take more public comment January 17th at Jefferson. A vote is scheduled January 23rd. Nearly 24 people testified at last night's school board meeting, most against the proposals. About half were adults, many of them from the Neighborhood School Alliance, a group that formed last year in opposition to school closures around the district. Members have called elements of the proposal racist because they would impose uniform attire on the predominantly African-American students at Jefferson and create single-sex schools, a structure that exists nowhere else in the district. The plan would break Jefferson into 3 mini-schools, a co-ed 9th through 12th grade Arts and Technology Academy, a co-ed 9th through 12th grade International Baccalaureate and Environmental Studies Academy, and a 7th through 12th grade Young Men's Leadership Academy. Harriet Tubman Middle School would become a 7th through 12th grade Young Women's Leadership Academy focused on science and technology, and most elementary schools that feed into Jefferson would change to kindergarten through 8th grade schools. The conversion would be phased in over 2 or 3 years, starting next school year. A community team would plan the order in which changes would roll out. Though the plan contains many aspects, the uniform attire requirement drew the most attention. That part of the proposal does not require a school board vote. Brittany Marcel, a Jefferson freshman, drew a comparison to Skyline Elementary School's recently approved conversion to kindergarten through 8th grade. families there would be able to send their children elsewhere if they don't support the configuration. Under the district's transfer policy and federal requirements, low-income, low-achieving Jefferson students have the first shot at transfer to other schools if space allows. Elementary students do not have the same priority because their schools are not classified as making inadequate academic progress under federal law. This is Angela Hancock-Revis for KABU News.
The Portland-based humanitarian organization Mercy Corps is focusing its efforts this month on Pakistan. Medical staff are treating 2,000 patients each week, and in Kashmir, the organization is providing clean drinking water to 30,000 refugees in a war zone. Live in Studio 2 to speak with us is John Stevens, who recently returned from Pakistan. Thanks for being here, John.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what's going on in Pakistan right now?
Well, we've actually had kind of a lucky break. Throughout most of the month of December, we had good weather, and that allowed our teams to ramp up and to really move into the mountainous areas to deliver relief items, to build shelters, and to keep moving our mobile medical clinics further and further into the remote areas. But the last report I just read from about 2 days ago says that the snows have hit. And this is what we've all been expecting. These are the Himalayas, and we knew they were going to hit. And so it's just a new logistical challenge for everyone there, including the people who are surviving this earthquake. We've got thousands and thousands of people still living without shelter. And it's difficult to explain to people sometimes what that means, but think about living up at Timberline with your family, some kids and some elderly people with you. You're out in the open. You have a tarp. You have some blankets. You have a little bit of food, a little bit of water. These are the type of situations we're encountering up there. The people have some really desperate needs, and we're addressing as many of those as we can. But when the snows hit, it just gets all the much harder for people. And when the temperatures drop, we start to see the spike in respiratory diseases like pneumonia, especially in children. We're starting to see those spikes right now, and so we're very concerned that the situation could get worse.
Now, you've traveled there yourself. Can you tell us what it was like and what you were doing?
Well, I actually was in Pakistan just doing some work in our programs in the south when the earthquake hit. I didn't feel the earthquake, but I went up to Mansehra, which is kind of near the epicenter, and also traveled to a town known as Balakot, which is one of the hardest hit areas. And the only reference point I had was the tsunami. I went to India for the tsunami with Mercy Corps, and so I saw some damage there. And the damage I saw in Pakistan was just unbelievable. It was walking into a city that looked like the photos of Hiroshima in the after effects of that. There was not a single building standing. There was not a telephone pole standing. The dirt itself was churned up. The quake just took everything down. And after interviewing a number of people in this town, I realized that only one of the people I interviewed was from the city, that most of the people in that city had probably died, and that the people I was talking to were people who had come down from the hills looking for help. So it was really, it took my breath away, and it made me realize the severity of this crisis and what it would mean for those cities to rebuild. But also, just traveling to the city took me about a day to get there. And it should have been a one-hour trip, but the roads were all knocked out by landslides, and there were convoys of trucks trying to get in and out. And so logistically, working in a mountainous area like this is so much more difficult than I think many of the tsunami-affected areas were.
So can you talk to us about Mercy Corps' Cash for Work program and what that is and how many people are participating?
Well, I know, you know, it's fluid. We have as many people participating as we can get sometimes, and the snows will slow that down. But I think now we have 4,000 to 5,000 people working in that program. And what's great about this program is that, you know, when everyone was talking about tents and tents, they wanted to buy tents and send them over. That's great, but that was going to take too long. And so what we did is we paid people to clean up their town, salvage the good materials they could, build their own shelter immediately. It gave them shelter, it gave them cash in their pocket, and it's getting those communities restarted, which is so important. And it makes them the primary agents of change in that rebuilding, which is critical.
Oh, that's wonderful work. Thank you, John. Mercy Corps will continue to post updates on the pending crisis and reports from workers in the field on its website at www.mercycorps.org.
Republican Congressman Greg Walden of Oregon said today that he will support Roy Blunt of Missouri in the race to replace Tom DeLay as House Majority Leader. Walden says Blunt is a better choice than Ohio Congressman John Boehner when Republicans choose their leader in the House next month. Blunt served as Majority Whip before becoming the acting Majority Leader last year when DeLay was forced to step down because of his indictment on campaign money laundering charges. Blunt appointed Walden a Deputy Majority Whip, one of the small group of Republicans who helped shape the party agenda and secure votes. Walden is in his fourth term representing the largely rural 2nd Congressional District in Oregon, which covers the eastern two-thirds of the state.
Oregon seniors trying to use the new Medicare prescription drug plan that kicked off this month are running into a few roadblocks, but officials are promising to iron out the glitches over the next couple of weeks. KBOO's Kirk Vandeveer reports.
The new Medicare drug plan is getting off to an uneven start here in Oregon. Some Oregon seniors can't get their prescriptions filled, pharmacies and insurance companies are being swamped with calls, and many participants haven't yet received their official plan ID cards. But Jerry Cohen with AARP Oregon says right now all participants need to bring is their drug plan enrollment letter, Medicare or Medicaid ID number, and a photo ID.
The pharmacy can then go ahead and handle the prescription and then at least know and make contact afterwards with the proper carrier.
Cohen said plan administrators expect the glitches to get worked out over the next couple of weeks. He also pointed out that it's okay if seniors are still reviewing their plans and have not signed up yet.
Those eligible under Medicare have until May 15th to enroll. We certainly are encouraging folks to do their homework and find that for many, by enrolling, they will save money, but when they enroll in the right plan.
Government officials say a large number of last-minute sign-ups are causing the problems. The new benefit is the first time prescription drug coverage has been provided for the millions of Americans receiving Medicare. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vandeveer, KBOO News.
The latest Census Bureau numbers show Malheur County still has the highest poverty rate in Oregon. Census figures for 2004 show the poverty rate declined slightly in Malheur County compared to 2002. But the remote southeast Oregon county has had the highest poverty rate in the state since 1995. A family of four is considered at or below the poverty rate in Oregon if family income is less than $19,350. In Malheur County, more than 18% of families fell under that poverty level. The state average is 12%, while the U.S. rate is 12.6%.
And now let's take a trip to the lighter side of the news with KBOO's Noah Eaton.
Greetings and salutations. I am Noah Eaton, bringing you the lighter side of the news. We begin this edition with a little less talk and a little more auction. Hundreds of pieces of Elvis Presley memorabilia were auctioned off over the weekend by a longtime collector trying to win back his girlfriend after she warned, "You leave the Elvis clothes or I'll leave you." The items auctioned included three Elvis concert suits, two of which sold for $125,000 and $50,000 respectively. Also sold were necklaces Elvis gave to girlfriends and friends, cufflinks he received from President Nixon, and belt buckles he wore. The seller, Jim Curtin, collected 600 cartons of Elvis memorabilia for more than 30 years and met the star several times. His unrelenting adoration eventually got the attention of Elvis, who personally presented Curtin with a white jumpsuit he wore in a Houston concert in 1974. So, why give up the lifetime collection? Apparently he's doing this to try to woo back his girlfriend. So far, attempts to reach Curtin, who lives in Philadelphia and has an unlisted number, were unsuccessful. Total auction sales wouldn't be tabulated until Tuesday, but organizers estimate the take could reach $2 million.
Oh yeah, special.
And finally, let's take a mystical journey across the Atlantic Ocean. Almost a third of young Britons have passed off a ready-made meal as their own creation in order to impress someone, according to a survey by the Department of Health today. Women were the worst offenders, with 40% saying they had claimed food bought in a shop as their own, compared to 22% of men. And 7% of the 1,016 through 24-year-olds questioned said they regularly claimed credit for food they had bought. The research, conducted as part of the department's five-a-day campaign to encourage people to eat more fruit and vegetables, also found that 1 in 10 had never cooked a proper meal for themselves because they, quote, don't know how. It also discovered that women were more impressed by a man's cooking ability than whether they owned a flashy car. So if you're trying to show off your little deuce coupe, you can forget about it. And there's your lighter side of the news for January 9th, 2006. I am Noah Eaton. See you on the lighter side.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 10th, 2006. We really want to hear from you with comments or questions about our new program format. Please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson. Tonight's audio editor is Kate Welch. Special thanks to reporter Angela Hancock Rivas. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. And the KBOO Evening News is Public Affairs Director Lisa Leving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Lori Hilliard. Stay tuned for Independent Native News coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m. You can hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, it's Barbara Bernstein, who hosts Focus Talk Radio. At 9 is a special one-hour version of Movie Talk, looking at the best and worst movies of 2005. At 10 o'clock, Andrew Geller begins a series on fascism in the United States with Larry Britt, author of Fascism Anyone, which defines 14 common characteristics of seven fascist states in history. At 10:30, the guest is Nora Arakat, a legal advocate with the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation. She'll discuss a campaign to get the Caterpillar Company to cease its bulldozer sales to Israel. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your community radio station. Thanks for listening and have a good evening.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 10th of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. By this time next year, the Sac and Fox tribe of the Mississippi, also known as the Meskwaki, hopes to have its own police force patrolling its central Iowa settlement. Pat Blank reports.
A tribal resources grant of nearly $390,000 from the U.S. Justice Department has allowed the Meskwakis to hire five officers and a police chief. The grants will pay 75% of three officers' salaries for 3 years. $160,000 will be used for equipment. The tribe must find the resources to pay the salaries in the fourth year. Tribal spokesman Larry Lasley says the Meskwakis do not intend to develop their own communication center or jail facility. Instead, they'll rely on contracts with other agencies for jail space. A similar contract is in place now, which has provided law enforcement from the Tama County Sheriff's Office for a number of years. In fact, in the fiscal year ending in June of this year, the tribe has agreed to pay the county for two full-time and one part-time officer. Lastly expects once the new force is on its feet, it will end the patrol and enforcement part of the sharing agreement, and that could cost the Sheriff's Department some positions. The new Meskwaki Police Force is expected to begin operating in mid-February. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
A program that helps train Alaska Natives as behavioral health professionals has been recognized nationally as one of 10 effective practices and models in communities of color. The Rural Human Services Program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks received the recognition from the First Nations Behavioral Health Association last month. Clara Johnson is director of the Interior Aleutians Campus, which was the first home for the program. Along with a grassroots village-based advisory group, the program is a partnership between the university, the state of Alaska, and tribal entities, with the idea that training professionals within communities will be more successful than bringing in outside social services. Johnson says people come out of the 30-credit, two-year program with a broader-based concept of mental health, as well as skills for prevention and intervention.
I think one of the things that was different about this program is we really wanted something more holistic, something that was more indigenous-based. So how do you deal with mental health or wellness? How do you be a well Alaska Native? So you didn't want to just go into a strand that was addictions or a strand that was just focusing on suicide, but all of those things sort of flow through the curriculum.
Johnson says the program was a way to bring a whole new group of Alaska Native people into the university system, but it has distinct characteristics not found other places.
The integration of indigenous knowledge in what makes a healthy Alaska Native, the inclusion of elders, to impart that knowledge and to develop teaching teams between the faculty and the elders.
RHS statewide program coordinator Janet Schickness says regional programs have been developed all over Alaska, and there have been 200 graduates so far. She says the model is important because it's village-based, and they've tried to stay true to the original mission.
So the students learn about, for instance, historical trauma. In addition to being taught, well, how do you do a crisis intervention? How do you support a family of the survivor, you know, the survivors of a suicide victim? You know, try to really bring healing to the people that go through the program, but also to help them bring healing back to their communities.
The executive director of First Nations Behavioral Health Association, Paulette Running Wolf, says of the 10 models that were selected as effective nationwide, the RHS program was the only finalist that was a specific training program, as opposed to just focusing on intervention.
And actually, the other ethnic groups are taking a look at the Rural Health Services model as a way to address the critical workforce shortages in their respective ethnic communities across the country.
30 more graduates are expected from the Rural Human Services Program this year. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C. Defending Native American interests since 1976. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.